He was involved in the activities at universities. He was at, professor at the University of Tarbiyat Mudarris in Tehran.
Oh.
And was teaching to the university students for some years.
Was it the what, Islamic history or something like that?
Yes. Okay. Yes. His teaching was regarding his, studies. And, his major and field was dedicated by himself into Islamic history, especially Islamic history. And he did a very big favor to the, library of Shia by compiling a very important book. That's its name is As-Sahih min Sirat al-Nabi al-A'dam sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that we may, inshallah, talk about it later.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Ziya, for a nice introduction. So, Sheikh Mahtavi, let's get to you. So his life, his scholarly personal life can be divided into two. One part in Qom, in the city of Qom, and being under the tutelage of outstanding ulama and scholars, and also in Lebanon, getting back to Lebanon and compiling some of his works over there, which was occupied by the Israeli regime on that time, tolerating such hard, difficult situations over there in Lebanon. Let's talk a little bit about this, this division of his life into Qom and Lebanon.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. My dear brother, if you don't mind, I think we have to have this correction that when we read his life aside, we see that his name is mentioned among the scholars of three cities, Najaf, Qom, and Lebanon.
Lebanon.
So it is not correct to only divide his life into
and Beirut,
two.
It's better to say.
Yeah, Lebanon.
Yeah, okay.
Why I'm talking about this point, because when we read the biography of the scholars, we see that, for example, Ayatollah X is the great scholar of Qom, or great scholar of Iran, or great scholar of Najaf.
That's right.
It shows that most of the activities or most of his scholarly life was dedicated to that city. And he didn't actually have this chance to be present in another city. And if he was in one of those cities, he was not in the level to be considered as one of the outstanding scholars. But with respect to Allama Sayyid Jafar Murtaza Ameli, we see that he is considered of the great scholars of three cities, Lebanon, Najaf, and Iran,
which
is mainly
the city of Qom.
The city of Qom.
That's
so
right.
It shows the talent of this great scholar.
Yes.
And as you mentioned, that his life could be divided, actually, because most of his life, or most of the span of his life, can be divided into two, in Lebanon and in Iran. Almost 20 years he was residing in Iran, and except 8 years, the rest of his life was in Lebanon. This is what you actually, wanted to mention.
That's all right.
I think I have to mention one of the qualities with respect to the personality of late Sayyid Jafar Murtaza Ameli, that he was truly considered among the scholars who dedicated his life to defend the Shia.
Defend Shia Islam, that's right.
Yes. As our brother mentioned, the contribution that he did upon the library of Shia is exceptional.
Okay.
So when you take a look in the works that he has done, we see all titles has something to do with the Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
So regardless the title that our brother mentioned, As-Sahih min Sirat al-Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, we see the title of Ma'asat al-Dhahra, we see Al-Hayat al-Siyasiyah lil-Imam al-Ridha.
Yes.
We see books about the actually Karbala, Imam Hussein.
Yes.
All these things has something to do with the Ahlul Bayt.
That's all right.
So it shows the importance and focus that he was giving to this point, that give him this position that right now all of us remembering his name with good memories.
Especially when his expertise was early Islam and the Shia Islam.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes.
He is considered as one of the biographers and historians that did a good contribution to early Shia Islam.
That's all right. So, Sheikh Ziya, when we say that Sayyid Jafar Murtaza al-Ameli revived Islamic history within Shiite seminaries, what do you mean exactly?
You know, if we want to clarify and explain this point in a sentence, we should say that his book is the first book is compiled regarding the life of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam by a Shia scholar. So we had books before him, but the book that is, you know, in 35 volumes and talk about every single, you know, part of the life of the Holy Prophet in details.
Criticize
the points that are not, you know, proper and are not relevant to the personality of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. We don't have such a book before him.
Oh,
so that's why we may say that Allama Sayyid Ja'far Murtada Al-Ameli revised the Islamic history from the point of view of a Shia scholar.
That's all right.
So we had some books of the life of the Holy Prophet before Sayyid Ja'far Murtada Al-Ameli rahmatullah alayh, but none of these books are, you know, derived out from the riwayat of Shia completely, you know.
So, of course, sorry, what do you mean? You mean this is the life or life account of Prophet Muhammad according to the Shia narrations, you mean?
It's not only according to Shia narrations, you know. The point is that we have some, you know, attributes of the Holy Prophet narrated by some historians.
Yes.
That we see that these, you know, attributes and some stories are not, you know, the
are not proper for the personality of Muhammad. That's right.
But, you know, these stories are narrated in history books.
Okay.
Allama Sayyid Ja'far Murtada Al-Ameli is trying to, you know, criticize the history by compiling this book.
Yes.
I mean, As-Sahih and Sirat al-Nabi al-Adam. And also in other, you know, of his, you know, rights and works.
Yes.
So, you know, the important point in his works is that he is trying to criticize and to make the situation clear for the who, you know, believes in the infallibility of the Holy Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. So from this point of view, this book is unique.
That's right.
And we don't have any background for it.
That's right. Especially when we talk about Prophet Muhammad, his lifestyle, and the infallible imams, there are sometimes some distortions and fabrications, okay? Yes. But Allama, as you said, Sayyid Ja'far Murtaza Al-Ameli is famous for correcting these fabrications and distortions and to give us a clear picture of what happened really in the life of Prophet Muhammad and also the infallible imams according to the authentic historical resources. This wusuq or authenticity of the historical facts and resources are very important for this Allama. Sheikh Mahtavi, his method and his approach to the study of history is called ijtihadi approach to history or tariq. What is this type of approach? Explain it a little bit for us.
Actually, the ijtihadi approach is a kind of approach that we are not going to follow one exclusive method or one exclusive opinion from one historian. For example, if something has been narrated with respect to the life of the Prophet, we can follow the one who is narrating this incident with respect to the Prophet, but the approach or ijtihadi approach is when we are trying to compile different views from different historians with respect to that single incident.
That's right.
And then try to evaluate their narration, which one is correct, which one is not correct, which one is mixed with the false things.
That's right.
This is something which is called ijtihadi approach.
That's
for example, for the ordinary people, when they want to get to know about one historical incident, they just go to the library or they may nowadays Google it.
Yes.
And whatever comes up, they read it. And if you ask them about that thing, they are trying to immediately say whatever they have read in
that page.
This is not the ijtihadi approach. This is kind of studying something and then preaching that something, telling the others.
Or sometimes the books and the resources are so much prominent and famous, which becomes the only reliable resources for the ordinary people, okay?
Yeah.
But according to the ijtihadi one, one book might not be very much known, but more authentic than the famous ones.
Actually, to be honest, someone who is going to take this approach for his studying, actually, he's not caring about the personality of the author. You say, okay, let's say this personality is considered as the best outstanding historian in the history, but
everything must be examined.
Yes, I'm trying to go over other
original
authors.
Sources too.
Yes, other authors, and then put a kind of comparison and see which one is true, which one is not
this
true.
This is very difficult.
That's why,
especially in the historical facts which date back to more than 1,400 years ago, and getting back to the prior original sources, it is a very difficult task for a historian, especially about Islam, you know, and the Prophet Muhammad and the infallible Imams.
Sometimes the researchers, they are taking help or getting help through the manuscripts, which are a kind of rare manuscript.
That's
and
right.
This is something that narrated in the lifestyle of Ayatollah Sayyid Ja'far Murtada Amili, that unfortunately his noble library destroyed in the bombardment of Israel, and he is saying that I lost all manuscript that I was benefiting from when I was authoring my books. So actually it is a kind of necessity such authors. If they want to create new opinions and ideas, they have to have access to these manuscripts.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaynia. We'll continue our discussion regarding the scholarly life of Sayyid Ja'far Murtaza al-Amili and his most outstanding works. I mean, Asaib and Sirat al-Nabi al-Azam, in our coming session of the program, inshallah, and his other works. I'm really interested in knowing what was his writing style and research style in that book. It was very kind of you for this episode. Thank you very much. And also thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. Visit our website at parstudio.com/Call of Islam page. Also YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
In the limelight. U.S. state terrorism on the international scene, including kidnapping of officials of other countries, should not be an impediment to the Iran-Venezuela growing ties that are beneficial to the politics and economy of the free world. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading U.S. State Terrorism Not an Impediment to Iran-Venezuela Ties. Stay tuned for more. The countries of Latin America no longer consider themselves as a backyard of the U.S. and are determined to assert their independence on the international scene. Gone are the days when Washington used to impose its extraterritorial will on Latin American states through installing client regimes and using the CIA to topple independent governments in order to plunder the rich natural resources of those countries. Today, however, the situation is entirely different, and Cuba is not the only example of determined resistance against the American floods. With more and more Latin American states electing nationalist heads of state capable of thwarting U.S. designs, the time may come for emergence of a new bloc possessing not just the political will, but the economic, industrial, and cultural clout to keep the meddling Northern Americans at bay. Although some Spanish-speaking states of the New World still act as servants of the U.S., they are actually living on borrowed time, with the people determined to unseat them one day through popular vote and the election of nationalist leaders, as has happened in Bolivia, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. The last-named country is definitely the symbol of resistance against U.S. hegemony and plots to undermine it. First, it was the famous Hugo Chavez that humbled the successive U.S. regimes at every turn. And now it is Nicolas Maduro, whose solid support amongst the people of Venezuela has frustrated Washington's every sinister design. Venezuela has had excellent relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran, and Tehran has never spared any effort to support Caracas, stand firm on its feet. The two oil-rich countries' ties are not limited to the hydrocarbon sector and the exchange of vital fuel to offset the illegal U.S. sanctions on their respective peoples, as is evidenced by the scheduled sale in the next few days of a supertanker to Iran carrying 2 million barrels of heavy crude from Venezuela. It should be recalled that last month, Iran had sent a supertanker to Venezuela loaded with 2.1 million barrels of condensate to ease that friendly country's fuel problems. As Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said in Tehran recently during a press conference with his Venezuelan counterpart, Felix Plasina, Iranian goods are accessible in several Venezuelan cities. This was a reference to the huge supermarket Megasis in Caracas and its branches in other cities, supplying a variety of Iranian products to the Venezuelan people, including tractors, plastics, detergents, clothing, foodstuffs, nuts, home appliances, carpets, construction materials, and hundreds of other items. This is indeed a sign of healthy and constructive relations between the two countries, which will be further boosted with the signing of a 20-year economic cooperation agreement during President Maduro's scheduled visit to Tehran in the following month. The Venezuelan foreign minister, who had met President Hojatul Islam, Dr. Sayed Ebrahim Raisi, was told by Iran's chief executive that the Islamic Republic is determined to expand relations in all fields with Latin American states, especially Venezuela. To sum up, USSA terrorism on the international scene, including kidnapping of officials of other countries, should not be an impediment to the two countries' growing ties that are beneficial to the politics and economy of the free world.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The face-off between the Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro and the opposition led by Juan Guaido has put Caracas in a years-long political impasse and economic crisis. Several rounds of talks in recent years have been futile, and the two sides have failed to reach a consensus. In August, the Venezuelan government and the opposition began a new round of negotiations in Mexico City aimed at overcoming Venezuela's political and economic crisis. The dialogue was mediated by Norway. However, the latest developments have hampered the process of a possible settlement. Venezuela's government has decided to suspend the talks after Cape Verde extradited a Venezuelan envoy named Alex Saab to the United States on money laundering charges on Saturday. Saab was arrested in Cape Verde under a U.S. arrest warrant in June 2020 when his plane stopped there to refuel. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro lashed out at the U.S. for what he called kidnapping of an envoy to face an American court.
Saab was taken yesterday, skirting over everything. A plane arrived, assassins, hitmen came down. They sought him out and they removed him with blows from the jail he was held. They took him without advising lawyers, the family, nobody. A kidnapping by the United States government of an international diplomat.
Jorge Rodriguez, who heads the government's negotiating team, described the government's decision as a deep expression of protest over the brutal aggression against Alex Saab. He also called on Washington to release Saab immediately.
Venezuela is alerting the world that the life of Alex Saab is in danger. It's in the hands of judicial system that is directed at harming Venezuela. And we demand his immediate release by the American government.
The U.S. charged Saab in 2019 in connection with a bribery scheme and sanctioned him for allegedly orchestrating a corruption network that allowed Caracas to profit from a state-run food subsidy program. However, Saab's lawyers have denied the U.S. charges as politically motivated.
This is absolutely a political attack on Venezuela, and it is a kidnapping. This shows just how far in lawlessness the United States is willing to go and how much they are determined to attack Venezuela.
Meanwhile, U.S.-backed opposition figure Juan Guaido reacted to the decision to suspend the talks, accusing the government of evading the nation's problems. Caracas aims to ease U.S.-led sanctions on the Venezuelan nation, while the opposition says it aims to use the talks to secure guarantees for regional elections to be held in the fall. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after U.S.-backed opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed that Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. Then, United States refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, imposed sanctions on the crisis-hit economy of the Latin American nation, and froze millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in the U.S. bank account. Washington has been using sanctions as leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro in what has been termed economic terrorism. Venezuela has faced chronic shortages of food and medicine as a result of U.S. sanctions, resulting in years of political and economic crisis.
Well, this is exactly what the U.S. government wants to prevent. And this may be also an effort on their part to sabotage even the negotiations going on in Mexico. That how can the talks continue in this situation? What needs to be condemned and denounced is depriving any country of food and medicine, particularly in this time of pandemic.
While freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new, the U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of Maduro administration, but further complicate the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst a full-blown crisis. Seven people were killed and 60 others injured after a peaceful protest in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, turned deadly on Thursday. It all began as heavy gunfire erupted during a rally of Hezbollah and Amal movement supporters to protest against a judge probing the last year's Beirut port explosion, as they accuse him of political bias and being swayed by the U.S. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah has accused Judge Tarek Bitar of politically targeting officials in his investigation. The Beirut port blast in August 2020 killed over 200 people, injured around 6,000, and left some 300,000 homeless. It also caused further damage to Lebanon's already fragile economy. Following the unrest, Hezbollah and the Amal movement in a joint statement said the attack was aimed at creating civil strife. Hezbollah initially blamed the attack on the Christian Lebanese Forces Party, led by Samir Jaja. Later, reports from Lebanon's Interior Ministry confirmed that the far-right Lebanese Forces Party had started the Thursday shooting in Beirut. Hezbollah accused the Lebanese Forces Political Party of taking orders from the United States and being financed by some Arab countries. The Lebanese president vowed to hold accountable the perpetrators.
What happened will be the subject of security and judicial follow-up, and I, for my part, will ensure that the investigation reaches the truth of what happened in order to hold those responsible and instigators to account.
Aoun described the incident as painful and unacceptable. So far, Lebanese authorities have arrested 19 people in connection with the violence.
Well, the uproar and instability and confusion in the region are directly attributable to the United States, to the apartheid entity of Israel, and to the repressive and repulsive monarchy of Saudi Arabia. So the whole issue is basically outsiders doing their best to destabilize the region.
Abdulbari Atwan, a well-known author, has described the recent highlights in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon as an American Zionist conspiracy to ignite a civil war in the region. Atwan stated that the U.S. Zionist conspiracy to create a sectarian conflict in the region will fail. He said, sectarian conflicts have been created with the aim of securing Israel's interests and stealing Lebanese gas. But this sedition will not go ahead, and if it goes on, the U.S. and its allies will surely be defeated. In fact, the axis of resistance in the region has so far managed to oppose Western, namely United States and Israel, interests in the region and foiled their plots. Members of the axis of resistance include Iran, Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, to name a few. The U.S. has attempted to weaken the resistance axis by hatching different plots, such as causing instability and wars in the region for years. However, the resistance has always been ready to properly respond to these threats. For instance, Washington has always sought to keep Israel's enemies at one another's throat so that they could not give Israel trouble. But the resistance front has time and again proven that it will not allow the Tel Aviv regime to commit crimes with impunity, as it has launched retaliatory attacks against Tel Aviv, which have exposed the vulnerability of the regime's entities in the region. Israel's constant violations of Lebanese airspace are also a source of instability. This has been seen as a constant provocation by Israel, mainly directed at the resistance movement Hezbollah. Meanwhile, the U.S. has also been accused of creating an atmosphere of instability. On the one hand, it has imposed sanctions on Lebanon, which prevents foreign investment in the country. It has even opposed the delivery of fuel shipments from Iran, is in an emergency mode due to a lack of fuel. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador has a stir of controversy by making anti-Hezbollah statements, so much so that a judge ordered a media ban on her. The trip by the number three diplomat at the State Department, Victoria Nolan, to Lebanon, also proved to be controversial. Her purpose was to meet government officials and representatives to discuss Lebanon's reforms and elections. The question that arises is, what does she have to do with Lebanon's elections? Nolan was famously accused of promoting regime change in Ukraine, backing the Maidan protesters and opposition, which showed how the Ukrainian opposition is being manipulated by Washington. Coincidentally, while she was there, the deadly protest in Lebanon erupted, which resulted in the death of several Lebanese. What is for certain is that the popularity of the resistance in the region will be a severe challenge for the enemies, who are hatching plots against them, specifically Israel and the U.S.
Israel has once again taken advantage of civilian aircraft covers to conduct airstrikes on Syria, a potentially dangerous move that could have resulted in an enormous tragedy. Israeli warplanes carried out strikes on the Palmyra area in the eastern countryside of Syria's Homs province. A Syrian soldier was killed and three others wounded in the attack.
They can commit crimes with impunity and feel that they have enough political cover because of their influence on the governments of the world, and which consequently influence the United Nations. They're backed by the United States, and their influence over the U.S. government and U.S. foreign policy is tremendous. They have more influence over U.S. foreign policy than U.S. citizens do.
A top Russian commander said in a statement that Syria decided not to use its air defense system to counter the Israeli attack, as two passenger airliners were flying in the area at the time. Israel has repeatedly used civilian aircraft as a shield against Syrian air defense systems in its aggression against the Arab country. In February 2020, an Airbus A320 with 172 passengers on board was forced to make an emergency landing at the Russian-operated Hamamim Air Base during an Israeli attack. Back in 2018, Israel had to apologize for using a Russian reconnaissance aircraft as a shield during an attack, causing a Syrian S-200 surface-to-air missile to shoot down the Russian aircraft instead and kill 15 Russian and two Syrian service members. Iran's ambassador to the Vienna-based international organizations has criticized the International Atomic Energy Agency for its lenient approach toward Israel's nuclear program. Kazem Gharibabadi said silence and negligence toward the issue send negative signals to the members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. He expressed regret that the agency considers being outside the treaty as being exempt from any commitment and criticisms. He was responding to comments IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi made in an interview. When asked about the agency's focus on Iran's nuclear program and silence about that of Israel, Grossi argued that Tehran is a member of the NPT and must subject its nuclear sites to inspections and verifications, while the Israeli regime hasn't even signed the treaty.
You know, the UN does not condemn Israel because Israel has been very effective with their foreign policy and their intelligence operations, infiltrating every other government on the planet. It's because of this that Israel can influence these governments to not take action against them, either directly or via the United Nations. And that's why Israel gets away with this with no consequences.
Israel, which pursues a policy of deliberate ambiguity about its nuclear weapons, is estimated to have hundreds of nuclear warheads in its arsenal. The regime has refused to allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the NPT. The Israeli regime, which is West Asia's only possessor of nuclear arms, has so far assassinated seven Iranian nuclear scientists. But Iran's calls on the international community to hold the regime responsible for its crimes have fallen on deaf ears. Iran says the silence will embolden the regime to expand its aggressive measures.
The is in the midst of a global energy crisis. Prices in Europe, North America, and Asia have spiraled to multi-year highs in recent weeks. Energy demand is rallying as economies ramp up after the end of pandemic lockdowns, and there are dips in supplies from renewable resources. Energy demand is back today as the world economy reopens, but supply simply hasn't kept up. That is why U.S. oil prices have skyrocketed $120 since crashing to negative $40 a barrel back in April 2020. U.S. oil prices finished above $80 a barrel on Monday for the first time in nearly 7 years. High gas prices will only exacerbate elevated inflation and squeeze the budgets of ordinary families.
Well, we got a little bit of a return of demand as the growth comes off the floor during the COVID era here, and we got economies that are trying to recover. So there's a little bit of that going on. But because it's going on, I believe that global speculators are really responsible for most of the recent surge in global commodities in general, including oil, natural gas, and so forth.
In Britain, a shortage of the truck drivers who move fuel has led to panic buying amid fears of a shortage. After Brexit, many European truck drivers went back to their home countries and never returned. Some in Europe accuse Russia of deliberately restricting gas flows to the continent. But Russian President Vladimir Putin has brushed off allegations that Moscow is using energy as a weapon, saying that Europe's gas shortage is largely caused by systematic flaws in the continent's energy market. European electricity and gas prices have skyrocketed this year as tight gas supplies have collided with strong demand in economies recovering from COVID-19 pandemic. The International Monetary Fund says persistent supply chain disruptions and inflation pressures are constraining the global economic recovery from the pandemic.
I don't think, however, that this is going to continue for very much longer. The global economy is really weaker than some say. And I think when the GDP figures come out soon for the U.S., for the third quarter, fourth quarter, it will be clear that we don't have a runaway recovery. We have a rebound going on, but we don't have a really robust, sustained economic recovery.
Iran says it is ready to resolve the global energy crisis, provided that the oppressive U.S. sanctions are lifted. Oil Minister Javad Oji said that Iran has shown several times its goodwill to help stabilize the oil market and resolve the global energy crisis. However, illegal U.S. sanctions have hindered Tehran to reach that goal. He said that Iran has repeatedly declared that it would be able to swiftly increase its crude production to help alleviate the global shortage of fuel.
You know, the problem with natural gas is that the U.S. has imposed sanctions on Europe and others because it wants to export more natural gas. It's got an excess of natural gas, and that means it will dampen prices and profits of natural gas in the U.S. So the U.S. has had a policy since Trump of exporting and putting pressure on other countries to accept U.S. natural gas, even though it's more expensive than, say, Russian natural gas for Europe.
Europe is heavily reliant on energy supplies from Russia. Amid the current energy crisis, Ukraine and other Eastern European countries accuse Moscow of withholding gas supplies to pressure the West. The European Commission has announced a package of measures to alleviate an energy price surge that has sent bills skyrocketing across Europe. The approval of tax cuts and the joint purchase of fuel by EU members were among the proposals put forward. The European Commission has been under pressure to act on the price crunch. The wholesale price of gas has increased by 250% since January, triggering a knock-on spike in costs for consumers and businesses. However, countries like Iran and Venezuela are more than willing and more than able to provide the world with much-needed energy.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
اللهم اغفر لي الذنوب التي تحبس الدعاء اللهم اغفر لي الذنوب التي تنزل البلاء اللهم اغفر لي كل ذنب أذنبته وكل خطية أخطأتها اللهم إني أتقرب إليك بذكرك وأستشفع بك إلى نفسك.
Brothers and sisters, we were done with the previous part of the supplication. We reached the part where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, Allahumma ighfir li adh-dhunub allati tunzilu al-bala. O Allah, forgive me for the sins which bring about tribulations. Three sins, as we have it in our religion, cause descending of tribulations. Negligence to the pleading of an afflicted, not helping the oppressed, and the third one, abandonment of enjoining good and forbidding evil, which of course brings about different tribulations, not just for the one committing the sin. So, talking about the first one, about negligence and inattention to the pleading of the afflicted, we know that when someone who is broken or has lost a dear one, or is afflicted by any other trouble, pleads with his religious brothers for removing his grief. When this happens, it is human ethics and compassion which makes it necessary for us to reduce the sorrow from such person. Those who hear the pleading of a grief-stricken person but do not rise to help him, they are not only unbelievers but also inhumane. The Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam stated, من أصبح ولا يهتم بأمور المسلمين فليس بمسلم. The one who spends the night without attempting to solve Muslims' problems is not considered a Muslim. Attending to the Muslims' affairs and giving help and support to them, especially to those who plead for help, is the recommendation of the Almighty, His Prophet, and the infallible Imams. Imam Sadr alayhi salam has said, من نفس عن مؤمن كربة نفس الله عنه كرب الآخرة وخرج من قبره وهو ثلج الفؤاد. The one who removes the grief of a believer Muslim, Allah would remove his sorrow in the last day, raising him from the grave while he is delightful. And Imam alayhi salam continues, and the one who removes a believer's hunger, Almighty Allah would feed him with heavenly fruits. And the one who satisfies a believer's thirst, Allah would grant him Rahiq Makhtum, which is a sealed intact drink.
O first of the foremost, O last existence after the last, O Allah, forgive me my such sins which tear away my safeguards. O Allah, forgive me my such sins as would bring down calamity. O Allah, forgive me my sins that would change your favor. O Allah, forgive me my sins that would hinder my supplications. O Allah, forgive me my sins which descend misfortunes. O Allah, forgive my sins that suppress hope. O Allah, forgive every sin that I have committed and every error that I have earned. O Allah, I seek to draw myself nearer to you through your invocation, and I pray to you to intercede on my behalf, and I beg you by your benevolence to draw me nearer to you and grant thankfulness towards you and inspire me to remember and to invoke you. O Allah, I ask you, begging submissively, humbly and awe-strickenly, to treat me with clemency and mercy, and to make me pleased and content with what you have granted me, and cause me to be modest and unassuming in all circumstances.
Imam Sadiq, in another narration, has stated, "Man aghatha akhahu al-mu'min," anyone who answers the pleading of his Muslim brother when he is thirsty or sorrowful, helping him to remove his sorrow and get his wish, Almighty Allah records 72 blessings for him. كتب الله عز وجل له بذلك 72 رحمة من الله يعجل له واحدة يصلح بها أمر معيشته. One of the blessings is given to him in this world for arranging his life. This means it is really important for this religion and the infallibles that we should live in this world in the best way and best manner possible. Then Imam alayhi salam continues, وَسَبْعِينَ رَحْمَةً لِأَفْزَاعِ يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ وَأَهْوَالِ. And Almighty Allah saves the remaining 71 blessings for his fear in the last day. This fact, dear listeners, can be seen with respect to other traditions and narrations about being careful and not being carefree about what is going on around the Muslims. That's why we have been ordered, and it is highly recommended for us, to say our prayers in a gathering, like the mosque. There, the Muslim brothers can be aware of each other's problems and try to remove each other's grief. This is what we call human ethics and compassion, and this is what is necessary for the Muslim brothers to do for each other. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
In early October, financial secrets of some of the world's richest and most powerful people were uncovered. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists released the Pandora Papers, an expose of financial secrets, offshore dealings, hidden wealth, tax avoidance, and in some cases money laundering of dozens of world leaders, politicians, and public figures from across the world. Some 35 current and former leaders and more than 300 public officials are featured in the files from offshore companies. It surely wasn't an easy task to uncover such secrets. More than 600 journalists in 117 countries have been trawling through files from 14 sources for months. It's almost 12 million documents. In particular, it includes 6.4 million documents, almost 3 million images, more than 1 million emails, and almost 500,000 spreadsheets. The Pandora Papers show a complex network of companies set up to hide the ownership of money or assets. Imagine someone having a property in the UK, but owns it via a chain of companies based in other countries or offshore.
We just think that this is the point where ending tax havens has to be done. They serve no useful economic purpose. All they do is allow large institutions and teams of tax accountants and lawyers to actually really pit themselves against the poorest countries who just don't have the resource to fight that. So what happens is they facilitate huge volumes of money moving away from the very places where most of us want to see it spent.
These offshore countries or territories are in places that are first, easy to set up companies, second, have laws that make tracing or identifying owners difficult, and third, there is no corporation tax, or at least very low ones. With this description, now it's easy to understand which places in the world can be called tax havens. Places such as Switzerland, Singapore, and British overseas territories such as the Cayman Islands and the British Virgin Islands. Above all, the Pandora Papers reveal how offshore finances and secretive wealth have infiltrated politicians. Most of the names in the list belong to leaders whose countries are struggling with financial problems, like Kenya and Jordan.
The world is facing a shortage of financing development. So one way of deterring that is actually by countries making sure that any wealth stolen from a country is actually repatriated back. And I'm very happy with what happened in Angola, where the daughter of the former president, all the wealth has actually been repatriated back. What has happened in Nigeria, Sani Abacha and the group. And these are things that actually we need to see starting happening in Kenya, because we believe in Kenya there has been a massive capital fraud, people stealing and getting money outside there.
Leaked documents show that King Abdullah II has amassed a secret $100 million property empire in Malibu, Washington, and London. Jordan has been having financial struggles for the past couple of years. It's one of the poorest Arab countries and relies heavily on international aid. The Pandora Papers also threatened to sabotage the political careers of two European Union leaders. Apparently, the Prime Minister of the Czech Republic used an offshore investment company to buy a $22 million house in the south of France. Andre Babis is up for election, and this revelation won't do any good for his campaign. Meanwhile, a law firm founded by Cypriot President Nikos Anastasiadis is accused of hiding the assets of a controversial Russian billionaire behind fake company owners. There are even bigger names in the papers, like former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Before he came to power, Blair attacked the offshore tax avoidance system.
Millionaires with the right accountant pay nothing, whilst pensioners pay VAT on fuel. Offshore trusts get tax relief, while homeowners pay VAT on insurance premiums. We will create a tax system that is fair, which is related to ability to pay.
The name of Ukraine's president, Vladimir Zelensky, who once pledged to clean up his country's notoriously corrupt economy, is also named in the leak. But perhaps the biggest revelation is the fact that many of these wealthy people managed to set up companies to secretly buy property in the UK. The documents expose the owners of some of the 95,000 offshore firms behind the purchases. It's not clear whether the UK government failed to introduce a register of offshore property owners despite repeated promises, or London just decided to turn a blind eye to the whole matter. The Azerbaijani president, Ilham Aliyev, and his family are one good example. It's been revealed that the Aliyevs and their close associations have been looting their own country. The investigation found the Aliyevs have secretly been buying expensive properties in the United Kingdom worth nearly £400 million. So far, it's been revealed that a big network of offshore companies helped the Aliyevs secretly own vast real estate holdings in London. It seems that what the Aliyevs do is a very private family business, since Azerbaijan's president's two daughters, his son, his father-in-law, and two of the family's close friends own these buildings. For years, they have been buying London's prominent historical buildings, commercial developments, and luxury apartments in prestigious neighborhoods. The documents show that Aliyev began stealing from Azerbaijanis and turning the money into luxury buildings right from the beginning of his term in 2003. Aliyev is now into his fourth term as Azerbaijan's president. He managed to turn the tiny country into an increasingly autocratic regime built on the jailing of journalists, lawyers, and activists. Azerbaijan's president is also accused of orchestrating fraudulent elections and massive corruption. Aliyev's son, Haydar, acquired his first offshore company when he was just starting grade school. His daughter, Arzu, got her first company when she turned 19. Arzu lives a lavish life in London, and everybody treats her like a princess. While the source of all the money spent on these properties are still unknown, reporters found that at least eight of their companies received multi-million dollar infusions of cash from vast money laundering and transfer systems. The Aliyev family's rule over Azerbaijan started when Ilham's father, Haydar Aliyev, took control of the country in 1993. He was a longtime Soviet official, and after Azerbaijan gained independence in 1991, he started to gain power. Haydar Aliyev was an authoritarian, and under his leadership, Azerbaijan became yet another corrupt petrostate. The newest revelations show that his son followed in his footsteps. After all, a country that's never had a real election, and its leadership is passed from father to son, is most prone to corruption and misuse of power. It's not clear if anybody mentioned in the Pandora Papers will be found guilty or face charges, but one thing is clear. In the new digital world, hiding money is not as easy as it used to be. The Pandora Papers are the latest in a series of whistleblower-led investigations that have rocked the world of finance in recent years. It's surely the latest, but it won't be the last.
IRIB English Radio.